This is the 7 o'clock Let's Rock second evening speaker. I've been blessed and fortunate to know you all. And I know when I asked Willie to be my sponsor in Al-Anon, I was sure he had too many sponsees and that he would say no. But he didn't say no. And he is, you know, it says in the other big book that God directs our steps. And I believe that my higher power directed me to you guys and to Willie. I know that through his influence, I have come to the realization that unasked for advice is exactly that. It's unasked for advice. So without further ado, my sponsor and a great example, Papa Willie.
Thank you, Rob. And hi, I'm Papa Willie, and so happy to be here. And where's Raj? You know, he went outside. He knocked us out of the park today, and it was a hard act to follow. But God wouldn't stuck me here if he didn't feel that I could do it. So anyhow, I'm here, and I'd like to start with the 12th step. That's where I start my talks. You know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we got to try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, I'm not doing this because you just asked me to do it. But the book tells me that once I went through those first 11 steps, I had a price to pay. I had an obligation, not just a wish. I had an obligation to practice these principles in all my affairs, but also carry this message to you. And if somebody gives one thing out of what I said tonight, I've done my job. That's all I want. One person to hear one thing, then one thing that I said that will make their lives better, then I'm fine. Because making your life better causes mine to get better. And what I learned a long time ago is, and my sponsor Bob used to tell me this all the time, he said, Willie, you keep your mouth shut, and please don't make a bad situation worse. So that's what I get to do. My wife goes off and want to get into some of those intimate conversations that's going to lead to chaos and calamity. I learned to keep my mouth shut. Because why? Because at the end of the day, you know, I know at the end of the day, we both gonna have to make a lot of amends to each other or carry this mess around for the rest of our lives. So I try not to do that. Let me share with you how I got here. Well, I have to start. It started many, many years ago. I was born in a little town called Galveston, Texas. And that's been 85 years ago. And, you know, and this is where I picked up this great tan. So if you guys ever been there, you know, you come back looking like me, you said, oh boy, what happened? So the guys asked me to talk about the 12 steps, and Roger did such a great job with it, and I'll just do some other things. Tell you a little bit about me, how I got here, and in those real difficult times and spaces in my life. I'm one of four. No, I got four, one of five. I forget my younger sister was born 10 years after me. But it was my mom and dad and my older sister, myself. No alcohol in the home, no drinking alcohol in the home. But I wasn't absorbed from alcoholism because my favorite uncle was one of these guys. He lived in Kansas City, And he's the reason I dress the way I do, because he sent me these suits back from Kansas City. And man, I thought I was hot stuff. But anyhow, he would come to town, and he'd say, Uncle Son is coming to town. I know I'm going to get something. He'd come to town. His wife and my dad and mom, they all went out on Friday night, you know, to hit the town. They come home on Friday night, he comes home on Tuesday. Didn't know where he's been, how he got there, how he even got home. So that was he was the first alcoholic in my life. Then my aunt, my mom's sister, my mother was the oldest of her family. They were all migrated to Texas from Louisiana. Galveston was a hot spot in the years I was born. I mean, it was the city. It wasn't no Miami Beach that was popular. There was no other beaches in the South that was as popular that. They called it Sin City of the South. Some of Al Capone's men, you look it up, I'm gonna tell you, died in the Galveston. It was a gangster town. I mean, you go out on the beach in the daytime, you have these nice restaurants on the pier. In the daytime, at nighttime, they turn into illegal casinos. And the Texas Rangers would come up and they just push a button and turn right back into a restaurant. That's what the kind of town it was. It was a seaport town. It had a red light district. And if you guys don't know what a red light district is, then I don't know what to tell you. It's one of those districts where they got a little red light in there, and boy, you get for they call it now when the pleasures after this, if you have one of these massage people, the after pleasure, that's what the red light district is.
Happy ending.
Happy ending, is that? Somebody's been there. Yeah, somebody's been there. So that's what it was like. So let me share a little bit about the family and where my Al-Anonism started very early. My aunt was married to a drunk. Nicest guy in the world before he got the booze in him. He'd take one drink, he went from a nice, kind to a raging Frankenstein. And he would beat up my aunt and she'd run to us. And so she'd come to our home. We lived in the projects. Oh, I should have said that was, I should call them by their proper name, government housing. But we lived in the projects, guys, in Texas. And that's where all of my family lived. So my aunt would come and run and hide from me. We did refuge for her. And so one day, while she was there, my mom and dad came down and said, "What's happening, son?" And I had my little bat. I said, "What you doing with that bat?" And my aunt, we call her, you know, black folk call people. Everybody got nicknames, you know. She was my aunt. I call her A.T. And she came down and said, "What you doing, son? Willie Edward?" They all call you by your whole names, too. I said, don't worry, A.T. If Uncle Will come, I got it. Now, I'm 8 years old. I'm going to beat him up with this little plastic bat. But that's what it was like. So I hung out there, you know, until I left Texas. And I left Texas and ran off to Denver, Colorado. And I called my high school sweetheart, and I told her I was leaving. And she said, "Can I go?" I said, "Sure, I guess so. That's the kind of planning I do." I got to Denver. I had $10. We got $10. And I was so stupid enough. And, you know, I learned when I got there that God takes care of fools and drunks. So I got to Denver, I had the 10 bucks, and I told when I drove there, some of you guys are too young, because when I shared yesterday a little bit about waiting on that bus, you know, the bus in the South, we had to sit in the back. And if that bus was crowded in the back, that bus driver just passed you right on by. What a way to kill your self-esteem. You know, they wonder why we were killing and fighting and stuff. But anyhow, we got to Denver, and I still got this, you know, I went to all black high schools. I went to the first black high school in the state of Texas, oldest. I graduated, I'm also a member of the oldest First Black Baptist Church. And I'm not saying this stuff. Go there. They got they have what those things they give you when they have the historical, those historical events. You go there, it's the plaque. This is the first. And that's what it was. In Galveston also, where on 20th, is where they had, where the emancipation was signed and told. And right there, I got a picture of it somewhere in my phone. But that's where I grew up. And I got to Denver, and so the first thing I said were, where is the colored folks town? They said, go down on the Five Points. So we took the bus down on the Five Points, and then I'm 18. Was I 18 yet? No, I was 17, and she was 16. Because this was in June of 1957. So I'm 17, she's 16, two kids. And I told the lady, I said, here's my girlfriend, if you let her stay here, I'll go out and find a job. And I found a job the same day. I went to work, and when I left there, my mother and father finally found out where I was, and my mom was calling me and said, son, why don't you go to California? I got relatives there. So I said, oh, mom, you just always bugging me and always bugging me, but always bugging me about going to college. That's why I left home. She also, I remember something else she did. I remember that in January this year, I spoke down in Texas, and it was the coldest spot it ever had been in Texas. Broke record cold. So I told those guys, Mom's asked me when I was coming back. I said, Mom, it'd be a cold day in hell. Well, I got my cold day in hell on February the 20th, and this last couple of months, February. And Texas has never had that. I was in Dallas. But anyhow, I got to Denver, and I left with my summer clothes. I had my buddy pick me up. I did the little thing. My room was the third, was down the hall. So my friend came and picked me up. But I said, be quiet, man. I don't wake up my parents. And I threw my bags out the window. I was so dramatic. I threw my bags out the window, then he picked me up. We went and picked up my girlfriend, and we took off to Denver. Like I said, I got to Denver in June. I found that job, May or June. I found the job that same day at the Sheraton Savoy Hotel, downtown hotel, where Eisenhower would come hang out there. So anyhow, it's in June now, and I'm in Denver, in these short pants, with nothing short pants and t-shirts and stuff, and I'm looking out there at the window, and there's those Rocky Mountains. And they got ice on them in June. I'm looking at them, and so here we come in September, right before Labor Day. God in his infinite wisdom took that switch and turned that switch down to zero, and I called my mom. So I say, Mom, what about some of them relatives you got there in California? And that is why I'm here today. So that's how I got here. So anyhow, I got to California, and I was sharing a little bit with the guys what my life was like. I came here, I was pretty angry, and I was the black sheep of the black family because everybody in my family went on from high school to college. I went on from high school and ran off. So I got here, and when I got to here to California, we had the first boy, then the second boy was born, and I was living on the west side, and she got pregnant with our third child. We got pregnant, because she didn't get pregnant by herself. So we got pregnant with the third boy, and that boy we put up for adoption. And that's the reason I'm in Al-Anon today, because my whole, L.A. County, he was born in L.A. County Hospital right there near SC. And they brought him out, California Hospital it was. They brought him out to me, baby boy Williams, and and I held him. They gave him to the mother, and I held him. And 1 minute later, he came back and got him and said, it's time to go. And I took them and gave them back to her. And when the nurse took that child out of my hand, my gut, I got half of my gut with me. I had a hole so deep in my stomach that you could blow a diesel through it. And that was the beginning of, not the beginning, was the exponent, was the, ex, was, well, not the beginning, but just the prolong of my bad behavior. From that point on, I felt like, hey, I'm already this black sheep. I'm already don't do things the way they asked me to do them. And I'm already this guy who breaks all the rules and don't get what I mean, an embarrassment to everybody that has the name Williams on it. So I get there, I feel like a piece of shit. We get to Denver, and the reason we put the son up for adoption is because I couldn't find a job. We had these two boys, and I was telling you guys this today. At that time, you guys are probably too young to know, but in LA you have a Hems Baker's truck. He used to come around through the hood and sell donuts, you know, bread and stuff like that. And they gave us credit. So I had the Hems truck, I get the bread and for sandwiches and stuff. And they also had a Ador Bakery, whatever that, Ador Dairy. And that's why we got milk, eggs, and cheese. So we said we can't take care of this third child. So that was the reason that we sent them back to Texas. But in any event, that marriage didn't work. Wasn't even a marriage yet, because we didn't get married. That didn't work. And so then that was my series of looking for Mrs. Wright. Mrs. Wright, right? From one relationship to another. After that, I went home. My dad died suddenly. I thought it was my fault, because he had never been sick a day in his life in 1960. Right after my son was born, he found out about it, and he got sick. Never got to see him. I'm driving home driving from California to Texas on November 22nd, I think, 1960. And I get to El Paso, and I call my mom and say, Mom, how is Dad? She says, son, you don't have to hurry. Your dad just died. Mm-hmm. See, so that was one more piece of shit that I am. One more bad thing that happened in my life. One more thing that caused me to be this fire plug. And I got this job at GM, and the first day I went to work there, I was 21 years old. First day I went to work there, the foreman was hollering at me. I picked up a bumper and chased him down the highway and threw it down the aisle and threw it at him. That's how angry I was. They took me to labor relations. They said, we'll give you another chance. The next day, he didn't learn his lesson. So he started again, I threw a hammer at him. It took me back again. 2 or 3 weeks later, the guys voted me union rep. Anybody this crazy, this crazy, we want him to represent us. So I was union rep. Like I'm telling you guys, I was a trailblazer. I've been as angry as I was. I've been a trailblazer all my life. I've been the first in a lot of things. And so I was the youngest person that looked like me to ever be a union rep at General Motors. I was 22 years old, 22 to 26, and then I was helping a guy save his job, and the foreman made the mistake of screaming and yelling at me, and I punched him and knocked him out. They say, you got to go, dude. But I thought it was the worst day of my life, but that was the best, because I always wanted to be in business for myself. I'd been going to school at night for radio and TV repair. So at that time, I said, okay. I opened my first business. I was going to school, and my friend who I was helping him out fixing television, he said, okay, I'll give you you have some parts, you got all your tools. And I opened my business, took 10 bucks. Wrote TV on the screen. And that's how I started in July 1966. And I've been self-employed ever since. I haven't had to punch a clock or punch somebody for the last 65 years. So that's how it would happen. So I move forward and just from relationship to relationship at dad's funeral while we were at home. this only me can hear this, so I don't want this to be nobody else to hear this, but maybe I shouldn't say it. But anyhow, during that time, my girlfriend started dating one of the guys that worked for the mortuary. And so they ended that relationship. And then when I met my daughter's mother, she had three older girls. She had three girls, and I had the two boys. So we thought we'd start the Brady Bunch. And then we had, after 7 years, I had my daughter. Later on, that same daughter, I went to enroll her at SC. And while I'm sitting there filling out the papers and stuff for her, the guys in the office said, well, I said to them, man, I always wanted to come to, I love this school, wish I could have been here. And he said, what's your grades like? I said, man, I can't afford this place. He said, what's your grades like? I gave him my scores and say, send us your grades. I only made one B at the junior college. I had made straight A's and just one B. And I was the one who never thought he was smart. I just knew that I knew what to do, like Roger said, I would cover. But I found, first class I took was my miracle, accounting. And I love it to this day. I mean, I don't work. I get paid for doing something that I enjoy doing. And longest God keeps this going, I can continue to do what I'm doing. So let's get to alcoholism. We got into the record business as the same as a result of that television business. And then we was just rocking and rolling, and I was just too full of myself. I had very little respect for marriage. I mean, I was out there, sleeping whatever I could. All you had to do was say the right thing, and I was there. I remember jumping out of windows, being in men's home when I ain't supposed to be there, doing all the things that this is this guy here that you guys look up to. Yeah, those are the kind of things I did, But Al-Anon changed all of that. But I had no morals when I got here. I thought I was entitled to anything and everything and whoever I was, because nobody looked at me as a child. I was the black sheep of that family. So when those girls start saying, you're a good looking guy, I didn't know how to handle that. I just went ahead and did what I thought I was supposed to be doing. And that was my self-esteem. And man, it's the wrong way to get self-esteem, because you put your life in really, really as deep a hands as someone who has a drinking problem. So that's a little bit before me. And then after all the stuff and back and forth, then I was in my store one day, and by that time I was in the hood. I was in Fruittown. I had opened a store in Fruittown. In case you guys don't know, Fruittown is Compton. It's the bad part of Compton. Now, you're trying to say Compton got some bad parts? Yeah, it's the bad part of Compton. Ain't it all bad? No. But Fruittown was the highest. That's where Eazy-E and all those guys come from. Dre lived on the good side of town. Dr. Dre did, and Ice Cube lived on the west side of town. That was good. Those were great. Those were safe places. So people feel that these hoods are all ghettos. But no, there are working people in these hoods that try to raise their families the best they know how. But that's where I was. The Williams girls lived not too far from me, and was the kid that played with that great safety for the Seattle Supersonics. He first got with the dreads.
Sherman?
Yeah. He's from the hood. He's from Scotland. So what I'm saying is that it's a lot of stuff come out of that hood. And so that was a good town and a bad town. In 1969 or 70, my buddy and I started this record production company to be able to keep the kids out of the gangs. My little young brother-in-law was an original OG. and he was an original OG, and the one with they were red. You know, they were blacks. They used to ride the streets. You go, you see them on the streets at night, these long overcoats in the summertime. And under those overcoats and those little small bikes, there's some stuff under there that you don't want to see. So I tell my wife, you think when you're driving and you're looking at a neighborhood, you see these little small bikes and these big guys on them, that's not a good side, good part of town to be in, because that's what it's like. You can spot it. If you grew up there, you know how to stay safe. So in this store, in the fruit town, I met this lady. She came in and she was smoking a cigarette, and I said to her, I said, you know, young lady, you're too young to be smoking. She said, I'm not so young, you may think I am. And I said, no, you're not. And she said, well, wait a minute. Say, I'll be back here on Saturday. Me and my girlfriend are going out. When I come back, I'm going to show you I'm 22. So she came back, and she looked 22. And she was the one, that was my first introduction to alcoholism. Because what she said to me, because she taught me that my hearing was bad. Because what she said to me, she said, I've got this little girl that I'm trying to raise. So I said, can I come by tonight? And she said, I'm not drinking tonight. What I heard was that I'm a good girl. I'm trying to raise my daughter by myself. And I don't drink. That ain't what she said. But that's what I heard. So I went further on. I went to start dating with her. And then later on, she taught me that my eyesight weren't that good either. Yeah. Because I don't know about you, but there's always somebody in that hood that caused her to drink. You know, and who, you know, up for me, it was my next door neighbor upstairs. You know, and so I come home from work. I was like you, Raj. I worked many, many hours. I come home, and she would be upstairs with the neighbors. And I walked in one day, and she was a little bit friendly with one of the guys. And, you know, it was one of those moments where I thought I saw what I didn't see. If you had asked me, I would have told you I saw something that was inappropriate. But by the time she got downstairs and walked through that door, because I ran back down. I didn't want to see it anymore. So she walked in that door, and I had my hand and my finger and her face and these three fingers pointing back at me and said, guess what you've done? And what have you been doing? Why we ask the drunks like that stupid question? Say, have you been drinking? No, I just got this playing volleyball, you know, got this playing volleyball or something. So that's what it was like. But what happened was, I kept struggling and fighting with that. And finally, one day, we had enough. And she said, and I shared this a lot, when this CD thing is a little different now, but I had the little CD that I was going to teach her how she acted when she drank. So she agreed. I played, you know, put the little tape on. I brought her favorite drink, put some flour. I had a little flour and a rose in my mouth, and put the girl to bed. This is going to be one of those romantic nights. I walk in, I put the drink down, and before I can get started, she picked it up. I said, wait, testing 1, 2, 3, I got to get my evidence. So in any event, that's what happened. I took my little wimp drink, she took the bottle. Just moved down off the couch off the couch in front of the TV, and Bugs Bunny was more important than me that night. And the same thing happened that I picked up off the floor and put her to bed. The next day, she promised she'd never, ever do it again. I was so angry that I broke up all the crystal in the house. I just start down things, just throwing, breaking, and tearing up, and just tearing up the house. But guess who had to clean it up? She wasn't, it was me. So that's the kind of stuff that we do. The second thing I did, and this was the night she gave me the gift, came in and we talked, and she said that she would never, ever drink again. What happened that time? I can't remember what it was. But the event, after the event, she said she would never do it again. And by the end of that night, she and her girlfriend came home drunker than she's ever been. And that was the night she gave me the gift. I had a friend of mine that was an office mate in right across the street from me there, right across the hall from me. And she said to me, "Willie, I have a place for you. So go down, I got a friend, you go down to the 7th, meet at 7:30, go down to this place on Arlington. It's on Arlington, it's called Arlington, but it's on Wilshire and St. Andrew's Place. Go down there, I got a friend, he's gonna meet you there." I drive up there, get ready to park my car, and all I see, all the guys high-fiving with the cigarette smoke. You guys know who they were. I went upstairs. There was the kids with spiked hair and everything, and they were the guys, you know, those were the kids that Alateen. Then I walk into this room, and a lot of you guys have heard this. I walked in this room, and I was a player, man. I walked in this room, and I was in heaven. I was nothing but beautiful Al-Anon women there. Some of the guys talk about the blue-haired ladies. I didn't see no blue-haired ladies that night. And I sat in the back of the room, one did not look like a newcomer. You guys know nothing looks like more like a newcomer than a newcomer. And I stayed there, and I didn't, you know, some of you guys take forever to get the sponsor, not the kid, you know, 8 hours, 6 o'clock in the morning, I was on the phone. I was on the phone and called the first lady. She said to me, "Well, you know, call my friend." She had the great Spanish accent. She said, "But call my friend." So I called the friend up and I started my little 13-step route. And then she 12-stepped me and she became my first sponsor. See, God do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And she took me to meetings. She said, "Willie, this was a Tuesday night. There's a meeting on Wednesday night right down the street at Wilshire and Plymouth. Show up there." And I showed up there and I got to hear, that night I got to hear Gene and Jack Kissel. Then she said, "Well, there's another room meeting on a Thursday night. Show up there." And it was at Cedars. So I went there. And it says a Good Friday night meeting on Wilshire, Fairfax and Fountain, show up there. Here it is, man, I'm coming, here it is. I'm used to chasing my wife around, but now I'm at 4 meetings. And so Saturday night, I think I'm gonna be also, no, it's 2 meetings tonight. There's one on Saturday down in Silver Lake, 12:30, Living in Sobriety. So I was there. Monday night, then the Saturday night, it was another Chapter 9 meeting, and that's where I met Pat Snickles. And he was, you know, you guys know Pat and I helped once started 7 o'clock, Let's Rock. But anyhow, so it's a Saturday night meeting there, and then Sunday, I think I'm going to be off. No, you go up on to Riverside Hospital. That was a great Alateen meeting there at that meeting. I think it was the Baffin meeting then, I believe. Mm-hmm. No, the Baffin meeting was always Friday night. Yeah. But that was that meeting. And it moved to Encino. Yeah. So then Monday, I think I'm going to be off. And Monday I showed up. She said, "Show up at the Monday night meeting." And this little lady came out and greeted me at the meeting. And I got ready to shake her hand and said, "No, we hug here." And that lady became my mother-in-law. So any event, that's what my life was like. I got the program and I just start doing the work. I just start doing the work. And I'm gonna give you some stuff to take with you tonight. And I call it Papa Willie's 4 S's. The first S is sponsorship. The second S is steps. The third S is service. And the last one is serenity. Why in that order? Hell, you wouldn't go to Africa in the safari without a guide with you, else you could be eaten by Simba or somebody. So you want to have a, you need to have a sponsor to take you through the steps. And then once we get through those steps, like step one, do you know what that really means? Step one, say we powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. You know, Ellen tricked me a little bit because they dressed it up. Because step two, they told me that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. If they had told me I was insane in step one, you probably would have a different speaker here tonight. But it's that's the way Al-Anon works. Step one tells me that I'm absolutely powerless over anything, anybody. Some of you guys may have some young kids, and the kid, you say, we want to get them to go to bed tonight. And they go to bed, you sit there with them till they go to sleep, and you think you've had some power. You did that. No, you didn't do nothing. What you did was you came into the room and the child made the decision while you were there to go to sleep. So you have no power. We are absolutely unequivocally powerless over the disease of alcoholism and any other thing other than how do I get out this hula I'm in. That's the only thing I have power over. It's this big 6'1", 200-pound guy. That's the only power I got. Everything else is an illusion. It's an illusion of power. I get angry and tell you I'm going to do something. You don't do it because I say I'm going to do it. You do it because you don't want to get hurt, but you made the decision not to get hurt, not me. So if you can understand that, you understand that all the stuff that we do has no bearing on what that alcoholic do, say, or think. It has nothing, utterly nothing. So step two tells me, like I said, then they told me step two could restore me to sanity. What does that mean? That means that I can't do this stuff alone. I have to pick up the telephone and call one of you. And my sponsor used to tell me all the time, Willie, you just reason things out with another human being. That's what we do here. Step three, say I have to, just make a decision. Didn't tell me I have to do anything. Make a decision. So you can trust a little bit. Just make that decision. And if I make a decision, I got a chance. Then we get to step four. Till we take this fearless and moral inventory. Whoa. The only first step that we don't do, that's bad and we can't do, is the one we don't do. You can't do a bad fourth step. The only one that's bad is the one we don't do. And I have guys come in and they say, it depends on your origin, how you got here. I came in, the person, my first sponsor, took me through the steps, but my fourth step was a biography written. I wrote it all out, all the stuff I could do. But what she did was help me as I'm reading it to her. She stopped me. Oh, Willie, that sounds like arrogance. Willie, that sounds like you're not being humble. Oh, Willie, that sounds like this, something like you need to change. That's not truthful. So it began to take out of my biography my defects of character. And when I was able to read that to her, I developed a sense of courage. Because I was willing to let somebody else see my weak spots. So when step six said to me that we have to look at our defects of character. What is a defect of character? A lot of people want to say, what's the difference between a defect of character and a shortcoming? My defect of character was arrogance. My shortcoming was lack of humility. So you can define the two. You know, a lot of times people get confused. You know, the defects of character and the shortcoming. What's the difference? Well, usually my defect of character is opposite. My shortcoming is opposite of my defects of character. And they stop this, I mean, and they say to me, guys say to me, I'm working on my defect. You can't work on your defect. Step six tells you, you have to humbly ask God to do that. Step seven says, you can't work on them. Only thing you get to do is recognize them. Then we go to step eight. We make that list that we come up with all those resentments that I came up with in my early thing. And people, a lot of guys, depends on your origin, a lot of guys come in from AA with me and ask me to sponsor them. They get a little impatient with me because I won't go from the second day having them go through the step work. Because in Al-Anon, and I give everybody the benefit of the doubt, in Al-Anon, we don't know what the hell was wrong with us until we've been here 6 or 7, 8 months or 9 months or 2 years. I didn't know that I was arrogant until I was here 3 or 4 years. So Al-Anon behavior is very different from alcoholic behavior. I mean, my son was early on, knew and in 6 months, he came made amends because he knew the shit he had done. We don't know, the stuff we do as Al-Anon, we don't even know that it's not the right thing to do until we sit here and listen to you and you tell us what's the right thing to do and we're not doing the right thing. Okay, we get to eight and we start to make write down and make that amends. One of the things that I'm going to go back to the fourth column, and sometimes people do the fourth column, but whichever way you do it, my sponsor had me, and I share with people, whatever way you do it, I ask myself these three questions. How did it make me feel? Then the other thing that my sponsor was real big on, what was my part? What is your part, Willie? And I say, I don't have, Willie. Were you in the room? If you're in the room, you have a part. If you're in the room, you have a part in. And the third question that I get to learn, what can I learn from this experience? What can I learn from this experience? Every experience is a spiritual experience, and every experience we have in life is stuff we get to learn. It's an opportunity to learn. We can look at it as something bad happening to us, but everything that I felt was the worst thing to happen to me ended up being the best. And then we did, and what I also say, you don't go try to make those amends without running by your sponsor. Don't do it alone, because all you can do is make a bigger mess. So you go in, you call your sponsor, say, this is what I do, and this is what I've gone, I'm gonna make this amend. And your sponsor says, okay, let's go through this. They may even find out that we are so ignorant that we think we owe them, a lot of times we think we owe them amends that we don't. The person kicked me in the chin. Only thing that I did was be in the room with him. So why am I making amends to this guy? I can make amends to myself for walking in the room wrong, or not being where someplace else where he couldn't kick me. So that's eight and nine. And in my ninth step, I'm not just telling you I'm sorry. I'm telling myself not to do that shit anymore. I'm telling myself that what I did was not the right thing to do, and I get to not do that anymore, and also I can face not just you, but I can face this big 205 guy, however much I weigh now, in the mirror. I need to live with me. All the stuff I do and have you think about me is not important unless it feels right to me. So then it's just, then 10 is just a repeat of step four and five and six. We're just daily trying to make ourselves right. Then we have step 11. And you know, we do the prayer. We did a lot of it here this weekend. Then we have step 12, you know, what I'm doing tonight, carrying this message to others. That's my role. So, go off there a little bit and talk about some vulnerable spots for me. When about 10 years ago, 10 years ago, I was in my third marriage, and I had given it all, because I got there in these rooms. And in that marriage, I also wanted to be the best husband, the best father, and the best son-in-law that I could be. I was able to choose two of the three things. I was a good son-in-law, and I was a good father. You know, if you ask my wife, ex-wife, she'd tell you I probably wasn't a good husband. But the point of it is, I walked through that with my sponsors. This guy sitting right here, when I was having problems, he said to me, "Hey man, I got a therapist over here you can go see." And I went and I chatted with her because I was confused. I talked with her forever. And she told me, and she shared with me, okay, this and that. So I met with her several times. Then I talked with my sponsor about it. And one day I was at the Friday night meeting here up in, at the top of the hill, one of the places got burnt down. And I got a call from my ex-wife. And she said that my friends have done something for me, and despite of whatever you thought. Now, I was angry. I said, this is it for me. I've had it. Because I had raised my boys, paid for 27 years, paid the mortgage almost down to $3.5 million, like less than $4,000. Less than $4,600 or $4,600. And so, and I said, I just can't do this anymore. And she, please, this is a sacred room. She wouldn't put my name on the deed. She never worked a day in her life. I paid for everything, raised those boys. And I had enough. This kid right here with the hat on, spent a lot of nights in my home with my oldest boy. He's the oldest one ever treated Andy like he was a friend, not a freak, because Andy would have seizures everywhere. And this group learned that when he have a seizure, there's one more thing. The only place this kid was able to show up with, and I carried him around, and I spent it, and I cared for him like that. So when I left, and I got the phone call, I told him, Luis was another guy that was at the Friday night meeting with me. I said, man, I can't do it. I went to a motel right there in Glendale and spent the night and never said another day back in that house until Pat and who else was here? Well, Pat was one of the guys that I talked to my sponsor and she said, you got X amount of days to get your stuff out. And he said, okay, well, it's time. And so I'm 75 years old then, 75, 76 years old then. So I went over, Pat brought his truck, we loaded stuff up, and I was escorted into the house I had paid for 22 years. I was escorted in and out. These guys took me in, and he let me keep my stuff in a garage. In his garage. I slept in my office. The first Sunday I was gone, with a kid came by, said, hey, we're going out and have dinner out in someplace. I don't know where the hell we went with a bunch of guys. And he picked me up. He picked me up and we all sat around. There was a bunch of guys. The first holidays with her was tough. I was a big holiday man on Christmas Eve, and I'm buying all these toys for the kids and stuff. And I didn't have that. So Tommy Alphabet had me at his home on the Saturday. This kid here had me at his home for Christmas Day, he and his family. That's the gifts we get here. Another guy who's not around anymore, I guess, I hear from him all the time, but he's back in Philly someplace. But his wife, I had Thanksgiving with them. So when I was out of that nuclear family, my Al-Anon family stepped up like they have always done in the past. When I got ready to move, many of the guys, Roy, this kid, Matt, who else helped out there, that's here tonight, Lee. So these guys helped me move and back to where I was. But whenever I needed them, during COVID, Diego brought me, I never had to go out of the house, he brought me masks, brought me toilet tissue, paper towels, and all the stuff that was hard to get. So the people who thought that I had helped and thought they took care of them, they were there for me at the time I needed them the most. So when they say that in the opening where it says that, in the closing, where you may not like all of us, but we love you in a very special way, they mean it. Don't take those words for granted. So I'll say I am so, 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 so grateful for you guys. I was moved out after we was having, I've had a sponsee meeting for 30 years. Several guys here come. And one of my guys said, hey, I got a room. You don't have to live in your office anymore. Come live with me. And I moved out to live with them, and I bought a bunch of stuff because I was starting anew. I was 77 then. I was 77, Raj. I was 77. You know what my life is today. And I started, and I asked around, do anybody, I bought all the stuff that I wanted to make it my place. So I went out and bought a lot of stuff, but I didn't know how to hang the curtains, didn't know what to do with the drapes. So I asked a couple of friends, and then one day a friend of mine had just moved into her place, and this little lady was there helping her, you know, trim the curtains and, I mean, trim the shelf paper and put the stuff on. And I said to her, you think she'd mind helping me? And she said, well, I don't know, I asked her. And so I asked her and she said, oh yeah, I'll come over and help. And we fixed it. We started that place, that room, and it looked bland, like a bachelor room would look. When we was done, it was like a Hilton S500. And I said to her, can I call you? Can I thank you? And she said, oh, no, I just fooled. I said, can I take you to dinner? No. So I said, so I asked her a friend and said, you think she'll allow me? She won't have asked her all these things. You think she'll allow me to take her, get her nails done? And she said, oh, yeah, she'd like that. So I called her. I said, this was the day after the Thanksgiving, November 2016. Yeah, November 2016. I called. She said, oh, yeah. She came, and we went to the nail place, and the big place she got her nails done. And she said, hey, why don't you get yours done? That was our first date. And so it went forward, and we had this conversation. I said to her, I said, I'm very reluctant. I've been married 3 times. I don't know how to do this stuff so well, and I'm so much older than you. And she said, well, you know, I've learned you. I know all about you. And but she said to me is that I'm afraid that you'll be in a rebound, and I don't want to be part of that. But the next thing she said to me, but I like you, and I like you a lot. And she said, I'm going salsa dancing. Thomas was a good friend of hers. So I'm going salsa dancing tonight. Do you want to go? And me, I'm 77 years old, guy. And here's what I said. Oh, she may like me. At 77 years old and all the shit I had done. And so we chatted a little bit more, and we just started to talk. We just did some 4 steps on each other and just kept talking. We got to know each other. We kept talking. And it was no sex before marriage. It was what it was, you know. Because probably at my age, I was okay with me. But but probably 20 years ago, it may have been a harder thing to do. But we did it. We did it. And all you guys, you know, John and his wife, Roger, John F. planned the whole thing. These two guys sitting next to each other were both in, they were both in the wedding party. Jack, he did all of the setup. Oscar and his kids came and did the catering. All these men, that's the first time I met in this little boy. He was 4 years old. Mm-hmm. When your boy was there. Yeah. So it was a party. We had a big party in Glendale. And every time I get despondent and get crazy, I think of those times, how those good times, because I have to have something to reference for me and my thought process and my mind, because I always, you know, it's not by chance that I've been married 4 times. Mm. The only person in that equation is me. So it ain't the other people. Yeah, I know, that's why I'm the sponsor. And my sponsor been
that was a charm, though.
And my sponsor been married 4 times. So we bring this down the line. So wow. But any event, I want to share that is nothing more frightening and more scarier to have to share amongst your peers. It's difficult. And if I said one thing, only one thing, like I started, that you can take away from this share tonight, then I've done my job. I've done my job. And what I read is something that I wrote when I was chair of another organization. And before I do that, I know I'm running out of time, but before I do that, I want to talk about Papa Willie's 3 C's. My first C is courage. And courage, how did I get the courage? Step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4. I got courage from those steps. And my second C is compassion. The traditions, learning how to do a group conscious, and if it didn't go my way, not to pout. Learning how to do a group conscious and recognize what is good for the whole. Ultimately, it's going to be good for me. And that's how I learned compassion. And last but not least, when you add the courage to compassion, you come up with the concepts of ultimate bit of character. Courage for the steps, compassion for the traditions, and character with the 12 concepts. When I tell you I was a trailblazer, I've been the first to do a lot of things I've done. The first GR for 7 o'clock, that's right, not only did that, but also the first person that looks like me to be to help Pat start this meeting. Secondly, I was the first person that looked like me to be a DR for District 24. First person to look like me who got to be the Alateen sponsor for the 1995 International Convention down in San Diego, mm-hmm. when there was only, there was over 1,000 kids from all over the world. First person that looked like me that's been your area delegate. I'm the first and the last. There's never been one before me and one after me. So I went to the World Service Conference to represent Southern California. There's never been a man that who looked like me to do that, and has not been a man who followed me. There's never been a man that was voted by this area who looks like me to be the regional trustee for this area. There's never been a man like me who have done so many of the things that we do here. So, what does that tell me? That if I suit up and show up and follow these principles in all my affairs, my life would be better than I ever dreamed it to be. I'm gonna read something that I wrote when I was chair of the board for another 12-step organization that deals with money. In my chairperson speech, at the end of it, I said, "Now it's up to me, and I'll make this Allen line. It's up to me to keep Allen alive. It's up to me to reach out my hand to the newcomer. It's up to me to be of service. It's up to me to carry the message to the person who is still suffering out there. It's up to me to protect Al-Anon's unity," and that's the first tradition. "It's up to me to practice these principles in all my affairs. Therefore, it's up to me to keep this Al-Anon program alive." With this, guys, I love you. Papa Willie is out of here.